Good afternoon, and welcome to the recording of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, August 31st. I'm your reader, Bob Young. Today, the paper is predicting showers with a high of 77 and a low of 48. Looking at the stories on the front page, Tracing DeJoy's Journey to USPS, Aftermath of Laura, Ducks Followed by Diesel. Tracing DeJoy's Journey to USPS, and this is filed by the Associated Press, and opens up with a photograph of Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, Washington. During its search for a new Postmaster General, the U.S. Postal Service Board of Governors was presented with 53 candidates screened by an outside company. Not on the list was Louis DeJoy, who ultimately got the job. Instead, in what Democrats call a breach of protocol and blatant cronyism, DeJoy's name was added as a contender by the board member leading the search, John Barger. He was acting on behalf of the board chairman, Robert Mike Duncan, a former Republican National Committee chairman who knew DeJoy and his wife through work on a White House advisory group. DeJoy, Barger, and Duncan were prominent donors to President Donald Trump and other Republicans. How exactly DeJoy was hired is among the questions Congress is trying to unravel as lawmakers scrutinize a series of operational changes at the post office that have resulted in widespread mail delays and fears that the agency will not be able to handle an expected surge in mail-in ballots fall as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. Democrats say they also want to learn more about the role of Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, who met with Duncan and other Republicans on the agency's board while the selection of the new Postmaster General was underway. The Trump administration denies any impropriety in the selection of DeJoy, a former supply chain CEO who is the first Postmaster General in nearly two decades not to be a career postal employee. Mnuchin has said he had no involvement, though his heightened interest in the postal service has raised questions given Trump's focus on mail-in voting. The Associated Press reviewed hundreds of pages of records related to DeJoy, revealing a driven businessman who turned his father's trucking company into a national logistics operator, clashed with labor unions, and forged political connections that eased his path into lucrative government contracting. His prolific giving to organizations and GOP candidates included $1.2 million to Trump, has also drawn a spotlight to the transactional appearance of some of his contributions. His wife, Aldana Wass, is a prominent donor as well and has been nominated by Trump to serve as ambassador to Canada. Her nomination is pending. The records reviewed by the AP reveal a pattern of DeJoy's family winning coveted opportunities after making generous contributions. In one instance, DeJoy's son, Andrew, secured a slot on Duke University's tennis team in 2014, while his parents wrote a series of large checks to the school's athletic department. The team was ranked 14th in the nation by the Intercollegiate Tennis Association and drew a host of top national and international prospects. But Andrew DeJoy was not one of them when he joined as a walk-on freshman months after the season started. Duke Athletic Department spokesman Art Chase declined to comment. A representative of the family's foundation did not respond to a request for comment. Wass, DeJoy's wife, and a physician who immigrated to the United States from Poland, was appointed President George W. Bush's ambassador to Estonia after she helped raise over $200,000 for his 2004 campaign. Granting ambassadorships is a common way presidents reward their top donors. She donated more than $35,000 to Trump's reelection before he announced that he would nominate her to be his next ambassador to Canada. Louis DeJoy also saw his federal work pick up while his wife served as Bush's envoy to Estonia. Between 2003 and 2009, his company, New Breed Logistics, was awarded contracts worth $59 million, according to federal spending data. During the 2012 governor's election in North Carolina, DeJoy, Wass, and more than 60 employees of New Breed from 8 different states routed more than $165,000 to the campaign of Republican Pat McCrory. "They've never asked for anything for their involvement," said McCrory, adding that DeJoy and Wasp are also generous philanthropists and don't just write checks, and they put their sweat equity behind everything they do. Wasp was selected in 2013 to serve as the head of North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services under McCrory, where she had a rocky tenure until stepping down in 2015. There are also questions about DeJoy's relationship with labor while in the private sector, given that he now oversees an agency where many of his 650,000 workers are unionized. New Breed, the company he founded, was sanctioned multiple times by federal regulators for violating labor laws. Though DeJoy was a Trump donor, it remains unclear exactly how he emerged as the top contender to lead the Postal Service. Mnuchin has denied that he or other Treasury Department officials played a role in recruiting or suggesting DeJoy to the Postal Service Board of Governors, which is comprised of Trump appointees. In an August 21st letter to Senate Democrat leader Chuck Schumer of New York, Mnuchin said that he was surprised to learn DeJoy was a finalist. David C. Williams, a former Postal Service Inspector General, who said he resigned as vice chairman of the Board of Governors in April after it became clear DeJoy would be hired, said Mnuchin was using a multi-billion-dollar line of credit with the Postal Service as leverage to take effective control over labor agreements, prices, and contracts with Amazon and other large shippers. In a fact sheet issued in response to Williams' claims, the Treasury said it plays an important role overseeing federal loans to the Postal Service. Ducks fouled by diesel. And the story opens up with two crates, each holding a duck that has gotten diesel oil on its wings. Waterloo. Therese Evans tossed handfuls of mulberries into a pan. Instantly alert, several ducks waddled over to feast on the small purple berries. Other ducks stayed flocked together in the corner of their enclosure, while a few preened their still damp feathers. Quote, "They're doing pretty well. They're eating a lot and starting to preen and pick at one another, which are good signs," said Evans, a master rehabber with Blackhawk Wildlife Rehabilitation Project. She spoke to the ducks in a calm voice, and they appeared more wary than anxious. "These diesel ducks won't be released into the wild anytime soon. After treatment for being fouled by diesel fuel, the ducks will need time to recover." Evans and other volunteers rescued 25 ducks soaked in diesel fuel after a tanker truck crashed into a home and overturned on East Ridgeway Avenue on August 21st. Thousands of gallons of fuel ran down the street and into the nearby waterway, forcing an evacuation of the neighborhood. Residents weren't the only ones impacted by the spill. Ducks regularly paddle in Dry Run Creek and nest alongside it, and some were impacted by the spill. "That Friday evening, I started getting phone calls about the ducks, but it was getting dark and I knew we couldn't catch them at night," Evans said. She notified Dr. Lori Cherney from Den Herder Veterinary Hospital, the volunteer vet for the Wildlife Rehabilitation Project, who quickly pulled together the treatment plan and medications. On Saturday, Evans' sister, Bea Herman, managed to net and crate 11 ducks near Hometown Foods at West 9th Street and Mitchell Avenue. Eventually, Evans and other volunteers rescued more ducks, one as late as August 27th in the area. "They couldn't fly, but they could run. They were definitely sick. Some were rolling over," Evans said. "It was raining that Saturday, and we were soaked, but we didn't give up. We did see lots of ducks that looked healthy and in good shape, but some were really affected." The ducks arrived at master rehabber Linda Nebby's rural refuge in distress, their feathers soaked, shiny, and stinking with fuel. Their eyes were burning. Volunteers, including Cherney, gathered in Nebby's pole barn to treat the ducks. Activated charcoal was administered to each duck via a tube through its mouth and into the crop a pouch near the duck's gullet or throat. Antibiotic ointment was applied to their eyes. Volunteers then washed the ducks with Dawn dishwashing liquid. There were two people on the duck to hold them and scrub them well, and three rinsing bins filled with water to rinse off the soap, Nimby explained. It's beautiful the way everyone came together to help. After bathing, the ducks were tucked into a warm, straw-filled enclosure with heat lamps to help dry them. 19 of the 25 ducks rescued have survived. They've been moved to Evan's property. I think the rest of them are going to make it, Evan said. Food donations have been received, including corn and duck pellets, and still welcome. If someone wants to donate, the feed needs to be 16% protein and unmedicated. They're eating like crazy. The poison has gone through their systems, and they've been hungry. That's a good sign, she explained. They've been bathing in water I've put in their enclosure. They're starting to feel like ducks again, the poor little things. It may be a few weeks before the ducks are released back into the wild. Their feathers will need to become waterproof again after such intensive washing. The ducks also have strong homing instinct, and rehabbers want to make sure the waterways are safe for their return. Crews from West Central Environmental Consultants removed soil from the scene and flushed storm sewer lines in the area. Boom equipment was set up in Dry Run Creek at Liberty Park to skim diesel fuel from the stream and load it into trucks. For more information or to make donations, go to www.blackhawkwildliferehab.com. Aftermath of Laura. For one family, Hurricane Laura, the third strike, filed by the Associated Press, and it opens up with a photograph of a man going through his ruined belongings and has the caption, Bradley Beard walks with a shovel through his daughter's destroyed trailer home after searching in vain for the water shutoff valve for the property in the aftermath of Hurricane Laura on Saturday. Hackberry, Louisiana. Bradley Beard calls Hurricane Laura his third strike. In 2005, Rita pushed a foot of floodwaters into his white wooden home in Hackberry, Louisiana, a tiny community in Cameron Parish, 15 miles from the Gulf of Mexico. Next came Ike in 2008, which pushed water up to the floor of the long mobile home where his daughter and two granddaughters live on the same property. Laura outstripped them both. It tore his house completely off its foundation and dropped it a few feet away. The trailer where his daughter Nicole lives with her two daughters was torn apart, the walls demolished to reveal a mix of clothes, belongings, and wooden planks. About the only things still in their place were a canoe and a garbage can tied to a steel grill buried in the ground. A retired welder who worked at many of the refineries that dot the Louisiana coast, the 62-year-old Beard, climbed through the debris, laboring with two artificial knees. After several minutes working to turn off the property's water lines, he sat on a fallen log and wiped the sweat from his brow. I got no other place, he said. This is all I got. Across Cameron Parish, the coastal parish where Hurricane Laura crashed ashore early Thursday, residents dug through what was left of their belongings, covered now stripped roofs with tarps, and took stock of the damage. The Category 4 storm packed 150-mile-per-hour winds, and the storm surge that Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards said was as high as 15 feet. So far, 16 people in Texas and Louisiana have died because of the storm. More than half of those were killed by carbon monoxide poisoning from the unsafe operation of generators. As of Sunday morning, roughly 460,000 customers were still without power, according to Edison Electric Institute, the Association of Investor-Owned Electric Companies in the U.S. President Donald Trump visited Louisiana and Texas on Saturday to show his support and assess the damage. Edwards called Laura the most powerful hurricane to strike Louisiana, a shocking assessment in a state where Hurricane Katrina made landfall on August 29, 2005. Out in western Louisiana, it was the storm that came ashore a month after Katrina, Hurricane Rita, that evoked strong memories. The damage wrought by Laura reminded many residents of Rita, which made landfall in the parish and wiped out many communities entirely, leading to one of the largest evacuations in American history. Nicole Beard had her second daughter by cesarean section 2 weeks before Rita hit. Quote, "I evacuated for Rita with a newborn baby and stitches in my stomach," she said. Many people never returned to Cameron Parish, whose population fell 30% in the 2010 census, the first after the storm. The Beards' next-door neighbors left for good, but the Beards stayed. Most people in Cameron Parish said they got out ahead of the Hurricane Laura, a storm that forecasters warned as unsurvivable. Roberta Holmes, 67, was one of the very few who decided to ride out the hurricane on Gulf Breeze Beach on Cameron Parish shoreline. Standing on her deck overlooking the Gulf of Mexico on Saturday, Holmes said she sat in a red leather recliner next to a window facing the water. She was confident that the home built after Hurricane Rita was strong enough to withstand this storm. Her home ended up suffering just minor damage, though the storm did uproot two palm trees she planted in front. She christened Rita and Ike. "I knew what it would take to survive," she said. "Now that the flood waters have receded, Highway 27 leading from Lake Charles into Hackberry and other small towns closer to the Gulf was a bustle of activity as utility workers and people pulling trailers or boats drove back and forth. The shelves were largely bare at Brown's grocery store across the street from Beard's property, and there's been no electricity to pump the gas. Not far away is a sprawling liquefied natural gas facility that Trump visited in 2019. The Beards weren't sure yet how they would rebuild. Bradley Beard lives on Social Security, and Nicole Beard works at a local alligator farm that ships hides internationally. She has applied for federal aid and is hopeful that volunteers and faith groups that ordinarily respond to disasters will be able to help them clear the wreckage. For now, they are sifting through their jumbled belongings for whatever can be salvaged, leaving food for their cat, which has so far refused to come out from under the rubble. Nicole's daughter filled a garbage bag, each with clothes. She found her high school graduation tassel inside the trailer, her class year of 1999 shining in gold against the blue thread. Her daughters insist that they stay in Cameron Parish, but she said, "I don't know how many times you can restart from scratch." Turning now to the Cedar Valley page, it opens with a photograph of two men fishing in a boat. They stand in front of a green forest, which is reflected green on the water. Treasurer's office clarifies property tax bills. Waterloo. The Blackhawk County Treasurer's office has mailed out real estate, mobile home, and special assessment bills have been mailed out as of August 28th. Due to the COVID-19 proclamations and transitions to a new property tax software program, there are some changes you may see on this year's billing. For those that have taxes paid by their mortgage company, it is required by law that the homeowner still receives a bill for their records with payment to come from their mortgage company. In the past, the treasurer's office was able to flag the tax stub requested by mortgage company. With the conversion to the new tax software program, they are unable to continue that practice. If you are unsure if you are to pay, the office asks that you please contact your mortgage company. If there are past due taxes on a parcel, it will be noted on your bill, quote, "prior year's taxes due," unquote. Please contact the treasurer's office at this phone number, area code 319-833-3013, for payment information. A tax sale certificate will be noted on the September tax stub if a parcel is in tax sale status. Please contact the treasurer's office for redemption amounts. Payment by guaranteed funds for redemption from tax sale must be in the treasurer's office by 4 p.m. September 30th. Guaranteed funds are cash, certified check, cashier's check, or money order. A September postmark cannot be accepted for redemptions. As mandated by Iowa law, the deadline for paying the first installment of real estate and mobile home taxes is September 30th. Taxpayers are advised if mailing in payments that a post office postmark date of September 30th, 2020 is needed to avoid interest accruing October 1st. Interest for September 2020 installment will accrue at the rate of 1.5% per month beginning October 1st. If paying in office, checks, cash, or debit card can be used. A $2 fee will be applied if using a debit card. Due to COVID-19 social distancing, there are several options to make payments other than going to the courthouse. Mail the payment stub or stubs from the tax bill along with your check to Black Hawk County Treasurer, 316 East 5th Street, Waterloo, Iowa, 50703. If you want a receipt, include the entire bill in a stamped self-addressed envelope with your payment. You can also pay online at www.iowatreasurers.org. Payments can be made by Visa, MasterCard, or Discover credit cards. A non-refundable service delivery fee of 2.25% per transaction will be charged. Payment by electronic check is 25 cents per transaction. You can also set up scheduled payments or recurring payments on the website for your convenience. A copy of the tax statement can now be found if you click on View Statement. The Treasurer's Office in the courthouse is open from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. Payments may also be deposited in the secure drop box located at the northeast corner of the courthouse. The Crossroads branch office is permanently closed due to technical problems. The Iowa Property Tax Credit Claims Form will be accepted up to September 30th. You may qualify for this credit if your income is below $23,810 and you are over 65 or 100% disabled. Proof of disability is required. Cedar Falls opens Section 8 housing voucher waitlist. Cedar Falls. The Section 8 housing program in Cedar Falls will be accepting new applications for the waitlist starting at 8 a.m. Monday, August 31st. It will remain open for the foreseeable future. Applications can be submitted online at www.cedarfalls.com/1063/section-8-housing-assistance. Individuals can complete and submit the online application for the program by selecting Online Application on the left side of the page. This can be done via desktop, tablet, or smartphone device. Paper applications are also available at City Hall, 220 Clay Street. They are located at the kiosk directly inside the front door. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, these applications cannot be completed at City Hall. A completed application can be mailed to City Hall or dropped off at the front window. Face masks are required to enter City Hall, and the community is reminded to abide by the social distancing markers in place. To request an application be mailed to you, call this phone number, 273-8669, after August 31st. Please note that an approved application places you on the wait list only. Current estimated time on the wait list before assistance is available is 1 to 3 years. For questions, please contact the Cedar Falls Section 8 program at 273-8669. Autopsy backlog pushes burials back weeks for some in Iowa. Des Moines, the Associated Press. Some Iowa families have been unable for weeks to bury loved ones who have died because of a backlog of autopsies at the Iowa State Medical Examiner's Office. The office is backlogged at least 2 weeks, and 47 families are currently waiting for autopsies, television station KCCI reported. The Iowa Department of Human Services blamed, in part, a lack of specialized pathologists and retirements at the county level for the backlog. Also to blame is a 25% increase in autopsies because of a jump in homicides, car accidents, and other traumatic deaths that require a full autopsy, department spokesman Matt Hyland said. The state medical examiner's office conducts autopsies for 96 of Iowa's 99 counties. To ease the burden, a new law allows the state to work with the University of Iowa. Quote, but they are facing the same challenges, Hyland said. They are also at capacity and oftentimes diverting cases to us as well. Christy Smith of Urbandale is among those caught up in the backlog. She and her family have been waiting 17 days for the state to perform an autopsy on her 21-year-old daughter, Madeline Wise, to determine how she died on August 11th. Smith said her family is desperate for answers. Quote, until you're in this situation, you don't know how it feels, and it's horrific, she said. Police supporters gather in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Scores of police supporters gathered Sunday in downtown Kenosha, where protesters have been demonstrating against police brutality since the shooting of Jacob Blake last weekend. Some attending the rally in the Wisconsin city wore back the blue shirts. Others carried American flags. They applauded when law enforcement vehicles rolled by. A Kenosha police officer shot Blake in the back August 23rd, leaving the 29-year-old black man paralyzed. Protesters have marched in Kenosha every night since Blake's shooting, with some protests devolving into unrest that damaged buildings and vehicles. Authorities say a teenager from northern Illinois shot and killed two protesters in Kenosha on Tuesday night. AG has ballistics in Taylor case, Louisville, Kentucky. Kentucky's Attorney General has received a long-awaited FBI ballistics report in the fatal police shooting of Breonna Taylor. Attorney General Daniel Cameron tweeted Sunday that there is additional analysis needed now that the report is in his hands, and there would be no announcement on the investigation this week. Cameron has indicated the ballistics report from federal investigators was an important piece of evidence still needed in the investigation of Taylor's death by police on March 13. He said Sunday on Face the Nation that he will meet with the FBI this week to have a painstaking review of the report. Democrats press for in-person security briefings. Washington by the Associated Press. Racing the political clock, frustrated Democrats on Sunday searched for a way to force the Trump administration to continue briefing Congress in person about foreign attempts to interfere in the November election. The Director of National Intelligence, John Ratcliffe, said most briefings on what the administration knows about efforts to influence the vote will now be given to Congress in writing. In the past, delivering all-member briefings in person, he said, has resulted in leaks for political purposes within moments. Schiff, the Democrat of California, said his committee would demand that Ratcliffe or other intelligence officials testify under oath, but that decision would be made by the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat from California. An official with Schiff's committee said Ratcliffe's decision was unexpected because Ratcliffe's office earlier had reached out to schedule an in-person briefing to the committee on September 17th. We will compel the intelligence community to give Congress the information that we need, Schiff said. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, August 31st, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, since there are no obituaries listed today, let's turn to the sports page. NASCAR, Daytona Beach, Florida, opens with a picture of the 48 car in pit row driving and leaving a stream of sparks behind it. And the caption is, Jimmy Johnson drives his damaged car on pit road during the NASCAR Cup Series race Saturday at Daytona International Speedway. Long after a fireworks extravaganza lit up Daytona International Speedway, and well after William Byron and his Hedrick Motorsports team ended their celebration in Victory Lane, Jimmy Johnson found a moment to reflect on his night, on his emotions, on his legacy. He pretty much covered them all. Johnson posted a picture on Instagram of his battered number 48 Chevrolet, which was caught up in a late race wreck and knocked out of playoff contention in the regular season finale Saturday. The crash meant his racing career would end without a record-setting 8th Cup Series championship. 7 it is, he wrote. I'm damn proud of that, in case you are wondering. Johnson was running near the front of the pack most of the night and was in position to make the playoffs until Denny Hamlin and Joey Logano made contact and started a multi-car melee that collected Johnson and 9 others with less than 2 laps to go. Logano slammed into Bubba Wallace, who slid sideways and nearly wrecked Byron. Logano tried to straighten his car, but Matt DiBenedetto rammed into his rear bumper and caused him to lose control for good. Johnson looked like he might escape the carnage, but Logano spun into Matt Kenseth, who made a hard right into Johnson's driver's side door. Johnson sat on pit road in his mangled mess during a red flag and surely realized that the storybook ending he talked about a day earlier was gone. Quote, the last couple of months, we've really been getting our act together and running well, Johnson said, after finishing 17th and missing the final postseason berth by 6 points. Definitely disappointed to not be in the playoffs. That was the number one goal to start the year. Johnson would have been safely in the 16-car field had he not missed a race following a positive test for COVID-19 and had a second-place finish thrown out at Charlotte after failing post-race inspection. He noted both setbacks after another disappointment at Daytona, a track at which he has won 7 times over 2 decades. He also has now crashed 43 times at the historic venue. Johnson handled the latest one with grace and dignity. No surprise, given the way he's gone about his business in an often glaring spotlight. He walked to Victory Lane to congratulate Byron and his team, including crew chief Chad Noss. Johnson and Noss were together for all 7 titles in the 48. I feel awful, Noss said. Let's be quite honest, right? Jimmy shouldn't be in this position. That hurts. I hate it for Jimmy. He's one of my best friends. He was the first guy that came by pit road and looked me up, revved up the engine, gave me a thumbs up. He means the world to me. He's a great man and a brother of mine. It hurts me, but it's what we do. We compete. We've got to go do what we need to do. Johnson will do the same down the stretch, looking to end a winless streak that's now stretched to 120 races. His last victory came in June of 2017. The drought led to Johnson's breakup with Noss and a new crew chief, Cliff Daniels. Cliff Daniels and those guys on my team, they pour their guts out for me, Johnson said. There's 10 races left, 10 trophies to go chase, and we'll have to focus our efforts there. Regardless of how it plays out, Johnson already has left an indelible mark on stock car racing. He won 5 consecutive championships, 2006 to 2010, forcing other drivers and teams to play catch-up, and added 2 more, 2013 and 2016, years after the unprecedented run. He's a first ballot Hall of Famer with a racing career that will be hard to match, let alone top, for anyone moving forward. Quote, the last 3 years have been tough. We all know that, Johnson said. I think we've shown some bright spots, and Cliff has done a really good job of leading this team and taking this team in the right direction. I think we can show that and close out the year. Sunday's baseball games. Associated Press. Denver. Eric Hosmer started San Diego's power surge with his 3-run homer in the first. Chris Paddock drew 6 efficient innings, and the Padres routed the Colorado Rockies 13-2 on Sunday. Hosmer's homer was 1 of 5 for the Padres, who ranked 2nd in the majors with 66 this season. Tigers 3, Twins 2. Jonathan Schoop hit a tie-breaking home run in the 6th inning, and host Detroit finished off a 3-game sweep of Minnesota. Detroit has won 5 straight and is .500 on the season. Minnesota has dropped 5 in a row. Yankees 8, Mets 7 in the first game and Yankees 5, Mets 2 in the second. Gary Sanchez delivered the first pitch hit extra innings grand slam in team history. Davy Garcia made a strong impression on his big league debut in New York, beat its cross-time rival to complete a doubleheader sweep. Cardinals 7, Indians 2. Adam Wainwright, the oldest active player in the majors, turned back the clock with a four-hit complete game on his 39th birthday as host St. Louis beat Cleveland. White Sox 5, Royals 2. Prized rookie Lewis Robert hit his first game-ending homer, a three-run drive in the 10th inning that gave Chicago victory over Kansas City and moved the team into first-place tie with Cleveland in the AL Central. Dodgers 7, Rangers 2. Cody Bellinger, Corey Seager, and Will Smith hit home runs in Los Angeles, beat host Texas. Giants 4, Diamondbacks 1. Johnny Cueto pitched into the 7th inning. Alex Dickerson homered, and San Francisco won its first series by beating host Arizona. Pirates 5, Brewers 1. Josh Bell and Gregory Polanco homered off Brandon Woodruff, and Pittsburgh beat host Milwaukee. Mariners 2, Angels 1. Pitch hitter Tim Lopez drove in Kyle Lewis with the tie-breaking run in the 10th, and Seattle rallied to beat host Los Angeles. Red Sox 9, Nationals 5. Bobby Dalbec hit a two-run homer in his major league debut. Rafael Devers hit a pair of home runs, and host Boston beat Washington. Cubs 10, Reds 1. Chicago starting outfield of Kyle Schwarber, Johnson Hayward, and Ian Happ each homered twice, and the Cubs pounded host Cincinnati for a split of their four-game series. Blue Jays 6, Orioles 5. Teoscar Hernandez hit a two-run single with two out in the 9th, lifting Toronto over Baltimore in Buffalo. Rays 12, Marlins 7. Wiley Adams' grand slam helped Tampa Bay beat Miami to the finish a three-game sweep. Braves 12, Phillies 10. Austin Riley homered, doubled, and drove in three runs in Atlanta's 10-run second inning. Dansby Swanson also went deep. Turning to the Nation and World page, Knox air monitors offline. Hurricane-related factory shutdowns can spew carcinogens, by the Associated Press. Hazardous emissions from a chlorine plant fire abruptly shuttered oil and gas refineries, and still-to-be-assessed plant damage are sweeping into the air after Hurricane Laura, regulators say. But some key state and federal monitors to alert the public of air dangers remain offline in Louisiana. While the chlorine fire was being monitored as a potential health threat, Louisiana environmental spokesman Greg Langley says he knows of no other major industrial health risks from the storm in the state. He said restoring power and water was a bigger priority. But some Louisiana residents and environmental advocates say the lack of solid government information on the state of air is typical. With dozens of petroleum, petrochemical, and other industrial sites, Louisiana is home to communities with some of the nation's largest cancer risks, according to Environmental Protection Agency rankings. In the Lake Charles area, with refineries, a major natural gas project, and other industrial sites, residents generally don't get any information except what the industry puts out, said Carla Crisco, a Lake Charles lawyer who evacuated the city before Laura. The area was among the hardest hit Thursday. Laura struck parts of the Texas-Louisiana coast with up to 150-mile-per-hour winds, with a storm surge that Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards said rose as high as 15 feet. An electrical outage that deprived hundreds of thousands of people of power and is expected to last weeks has knocked offline the state's stationary air monitors in the storm-battled communities. oil and gas facilities that the U.S. Department of Energy says account for 13% of U.S. refinery capacity shut down as a precaution during the industrialized, roughly 60-mile stretch from Port Arthur, Texas, to Lake Charles before the hurricane. The abrupt shutdowns and eventual restarts for hurricanes typically mean the emission of up to millions of pounds of additional cancer-causing soot, heavy metals, and other hazards from refinery smokestacks. A fire at a plant making swimming pool chemicals at West Lake, part of the larger Lake Charles area, since Thursday has on a few occasions sent enough chlorine into the air to be detected by emergency workers' handheld monitors, Langley said. Chlorine levels were not high enough to warrant evacuation, officials said, although residents of the industrial area around the plant were under orders to shelter inside their homes for days after Laura's landfall. With debris clogging roads, industry still is assessing damage along the Texas-Louisiana coast. No word of any major industrial threat other than the chlorine plant fire had emerged by 3 days after Laura. After Hurricane Harvey hit Houston in 2017, confirmation of more than 100 toxic spills into the air, land, and water took days, weeks, and months to become public, and many were never investigated. Quote, in a storm of this magnitude, there's going to be some leaks. There's going to be some spills, Langley said Saturday. We're still in the process of assessing that. I don't know anything personally that's major. Election 2020. Accusations fly. Dems. Trump agitates. President blames liberal politicians for violence. Rioting. By Associated Press. Washington. Democrats on Sunday accused President Donald Trump of trying to inflame racial tensions to benefit his campaign as he praised supporters who clashed with protesters in Portland, Oregon, where one man died overnight, and announced he will travel to Kenosha, Wisconsin, amid anger over the shooting of another black man by police. Trump's tweets came hours after a man identified as a supporter of a right-wing group was shot and killed in Portland when a large caravan of Trump supporters and Black Lives Matter protesters clashed in the city streets. Trump praised the caravan participants as, quote, great patriots, and blamed the city's Democratic mayor for the death. Trump has throughout the summer cast American cities as under siege by violence and lawlessness, despite the fact that most of the protests demonstrating against racial injustice have been largely peaceful. About 9 weeks until Election Day, some of his advisors see an aggressive law and order message as the best way for the president to turn voters against his Democratic rival, Joe Biden, and regain the support of suburban voters, particularly women, who have abandoned him. But Democrats accuse Trump of rooting for unrest and trying to stoke further violence for political gain instead of ratcheting down tensions. Biden, in a statement, said he unequivocally condemned violence on all sides while accusing Trump of recklessly encouraging it. Quote, he may think that war in our streets is good for his re-election chances, but that is not presidential leadership or even basic human compassion, Biden said. Quote, do you seriously wonder, Mr. President, why this is the first time in decades that America has seen this level of violence? Asked Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler. Quote, it's you who has created the hate and the division, unquote. The White House pushed back. Quote, the only person to blame for the violence and riots in our streets are liberal politicians and their incompetent policies that have failed to get control of these destructive situations, White House spokesman Judd Deere said. Trump prepared to travel this week to Kenosha, Wisconsin, where tensions are still raw after police shot Jacob Blake, a 29-year-old black man, in the back 7 times, leaving him paralyzed. The shooting has ignited new demonstrations against racial injustice and police brutality months after George Floyd's death in the hands of a Minneapolis police officer, touched off a wider reckoning on race. Representative Karen Bass, a California Democrat who leads the Congressional Black Caucus, said Trump is, quote, doing everything he can to fan the flames, unquote. Quote, I think his visit has one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to agitate things and to make things worse, Bass said Sunday on CNN's State of the Union. Quote, it is clear his campaign is all about law and order. It is a throwback to the past, and he's going to do everything to disrupt law and order in this time period. On the Religion and Advice page, column Religious Rhetoric Featured in Campaigns, filed by Karis Golden. Religious rhetoric will continue to feature prominently as we approach the U.S. presidential election in November. Each of the candidates, in their own ways, wear their beliefs on their respective sleeves. President Donald Trump identifies himself as Presbyterian, speaks frequently about God in the Bible, and he does not regularly attend a church. Instead, his circle includes people who describe themselves as evangelical Christians. These principles emphasize that salvation comes only from Jesus and must be accepted. Further, believers must actively and vocally share the unerring, faultless teachings of the Bible. Chief among Trump's evangelical supporters are the Reverend Paula White Kane, his personal pastor and spiritual advisor, and politicians like Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. The governor attacks politicians' religious motivation on issues ranging from marriage to religious freedom, while White Kane advises the president's Faith and Opportunity Initiative. Joe Biden, the Democratic presidential nominee, speaks openly of his deep religious beliefs and devout Catholic faith. Friends and colleagues allude to how Biden's beliefs helped him when his wife and daughter were killed in a car accident in 1972, and again in 2015 when his son Beau died of brain cancer. Trump slams Biden's religious devotion. For example, Trump says Biden's pro-life abortion stance is against God and hurts the Bible. Conversely, Biden tends to talk about the personal impact of faith and avoids conflating faith and politics. Democratic and Republican emphasis on faith and religion were prominent at their recent national conventions, too, if different in their approaches. The Democratic National Convention took place August 17th through the 20th in Milwaukee. It opened with a worship service that was both interfaith and ecumenical. The emphasis on celebrating varied religious beliefs was a theme throughout the DNC, with brief daily messages from leaders representing backgrounds like Episcopalianism, Greek Orthodoxy, Judaism, and more. That makes sense. Figures show that while the majority of Democrats identify primarily as Christians of various backgrounds, 69%, nearly 10 say they're Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, or Buddhist. The Republican National Convention took place last week in Charlotte, North Carolina, beginning with an invocation from Cardinal Timothy Dolan of the Roman Catholic Church of New York. The convention also featured two keynote speakers who are evangelical heavy hitters, Franklin Graham and Cassie Graham Lynch. When it comes to the relationship between faith, values, and the presidency, the impact on elections and voters' perception is murky. Voters tend to identify with a personal belief system, care about a candidate's religious identity, and want to know about their beliefs. However, we tend to place more weight on a candidate's morals and values during a 2020 survey by Pew Research Center. The survey shows 63% of U.S. adults say, quote, it's very important to them to have a president who personally lives a moral, ethical life, unquote. Another 31% say this is, quote, somewhat important. To show the potential impact of religion, values, and morals on the upcoming election, the Pew survey highlighted responses from a key Trump constituency, those who identify themselves as white, evangelical Protestants, to compare against all U.S. adults. Evangelicals aligned regarding it being very important to live a moral, ethical life. In addition, 67 said it's very important to have a president who stands up for people with your religious belief, compared to 38% of all adults. Further, 34% of evangelicals placed high value on a president having strong religious beliefs, even if those beliefs differ from their own, while 20% of all adults found this very important. Likewise, a third of evangelicals strongly prefer that a president share their religious beliefs, while only 14% of all adults said this is very important. Golden writes the Courier's weekly Faith and Values column. Email her at onfaith@carisgolden.com, and Caris is spelled with a K. Let's pick up one more article from the sports page, this one regarding pro basketball. Celtics make statement, the Associated Press. Lake Buena Vista, Florida. The Boston Celtics clearly have the formula to create problems for the Toronto Raptors. Jason Tatum and Marcus Smart each scored 21 points. Kemba Walker added 18 points and 10 assists, and the Celtics never trailed on the way to beating Raptors 112-94 in Game 1 of their Eastern Conference semifinals series Sunday. The Celtics improved to 4-1 against the Raptors this season. No other team has beaten the reigning NBA champions more than twice, and both of their meetings in the NBA's restart bubble at Walt Disney World have been one-sided. Toronto is 0-2 against Boston at Disney, losing by a combined 40 points and not leading for a single moment in those two games. The Raptors are 11-0 at Disney against everybody else. Jaylen Brown scored 17 points, and Daniel Theis finished with 13 points and 15 rebounds for Boston, which is 5-0 in this postseason. Kyle Lowry had 17 points for Toronto, which got 15 from Serge Ibaka, 13 from Pascal Siakam, on a day where he was slowed big time by early foul trouble, and 12 from OG Anunoby. The Raptors were outscored 51-30 from the three-point range. Clippers 111, Mavericks 97. Kawhi Leonard had 33 points and 14 rebounds, and Los Angeles eliminated Luka Doncic and Dallas from the playoffs, winning Game 6 of the first round series. Doncic capped a superb first postseason with 38 points, 9 rebounds, and 9 assists, keeping it interesting into the fourth quarter, even while playing without injured teammate Kristaps Porzingis. Leonard reached the 30-point mark for his career-best fifth straight playoff game. Nuggets 119, Jazz 107. The Jamal Murray-Donovan Mitchell duel will be settled in the first Game 7 in the bubble. Murray extended his torrid run with 50 more points, leading Denver to victory over Utah. Murray had his second 50-point game of the series to equal Mitchell, who finished with 44 in this one. No player has ever had more in an entire postseason. They will go at it one more time Tuesday night, with the winner advancing to face the Los Angeles Clippers. Rom wins Thriller at BMW, and it opens with a picture of John Rom in a red shirt, white hat, holding his putter and screaming enthusiastically. And the caption says, John Rahm reacts after making his putt on the first playoff hole during the final round of the BMW Championship Golf Tournament at the Olympia Fields Country Club in Olympia Fields, Illinois. John Rahm saved the biggest putt for last, filed by the Associated Press. Olympia Fields, Illinois. With so few people around, John Rahm still got word from the other side of the Olympia Fields clubhouse that Dustin Johnson had made a 45-foot birdie on the final four hole to force a playoff Sunday in the BMW Championship. Resilient as ever, Rahm went out and made some magic of his own. From one end of the 18th green to the other, Rob's putt from just over 65 feet rolled down the ridge and into the cup, setting off a roar so loud it nearly made up for not having spectators. I knew how good DJ has been playing. I was expecting nothing else, Rom said. I was fully confident it was going to come into a playoff and hoping to win it. Never did I think I would make another 50 to 60 footer, a couple of breaks in there, to end up winning it. Johnson could only laugh at his birdie putt, eliciting a rare show of emotion, a slow, sweeping uppercut. And he had the same reaction to what Rom did. What else is there to do? I played an unbelievable putt, got in the playoff, and then John made an even more ridiculous putt on top of me, Johnson said, who has been runner-up twice and won his last three starts. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, August 31st. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks so much for listening today.